The following is intended for bizarre audiences only. Welcome to the Midnight Library.
Madam, is that sea salt I smell? Is the captain here? Has he delivered the lady? I can't detect her.
Good morning, Mr. Darling. Yes, the captain was here, and no, the lady is not. The captain and I spent the night, comparing prognostications.
I wondered why I detected your special perfume. Confession, isn't that the name of it?
Do you know, darling, I've begun to suspect that you have a bit of bloodhound in you. Perhaps we should have you tested.
I'm going to pretend I didn't hear that, madam.
Uh-huh.
Get up! Get up, you lazy freak! It's almost 6 o'clock. If you're not on that stage in 5 minutes, I'm gonna come in that cage and whip you to pieces!
Oh, please put your whip away, sir. Mr. Pendle, please. I mean, Ringmaster. I'll make sure she's on time. We all want a good show, sir. We all want what's best, cries a small voice. Ringmaster was the title Pendle insisted on, but wasn't entitled to.
You get her ready, Goatface, or you're getting the whip too,
said the horrid little round man in dingy red striped trousers, as he slashed his bullwhip across the rusty iron bars of the rectangular cage, then stomped away, spitting and grumbling about freaks and money. The ever-present pungent cloud of sweat and whiskey fading away with him. Natasha, Natasha, sweetheart, please wake up or he's going to punish us all, pleads the young woman as she eases the heavy iron hasp over its crusty loop on the unlocked door of the rusting enclosure. Beneath a heaped pile of spent yellow straw, the lithe, dreaming woman stirs, propping herself up on her elbow as she winces at the bright stage light being shown into her cage from a few feet away. She smiles a heartbreaking smile at her friend, her fleeting dream of a faraway mansion, a home with friends inside, its walls lined with magical books, now completely erased. Look, Natasha, implores the ram-headed girl. I've had Janet wash and repair your dress. Let me help you get dressed. Slowly, Natasha begins to slide out from under the makeshift blanket of falling straw, her pale arm stretching upward, her wavy tresses falling over her bare breasts. From beneath the bed of straw, her green torso shifts, and her ample tail uncoils from around her, its sheen catching the light. Ramona, I'd probably be dead now if it wasn't for you, Natasha laments as she raises her slender arms to allow the emerald green satin gown to glide over her head. I fear we're all going to be dead if something doesn't change soon. He grows meaner every day, Ramona whispers, quickly picking sticks of straw tangled in Natasha's long blonde hair. Here, look. I've asked Janet to add some length with a little pocket added at the back, Natasha, So when you're working in the kitchen, your tail can be tucked away and it won't get trodden on. Leaning in closely while she zips up the back of the green gown, the ram-headed girl asks the snake woman, "Did you get him to drink the tea?" Natasha's bright eyes become teary. She purses her pretty lips and shakes her head with sad disappointment. "I can't get him to eat or drink anything I make. He's mean and suspicious," she whispers back.
"Move, move, move, you godforsaken freaks!"
screams the round, dumpy little man, his face now as red as his trousers.
"Both of you, get to your spots or I'll cut you to ribbons!"
He cracks the popper of his whip over the heads of the two unusual beings fleeing in front of him. The frightened girls hurry across the dirt floor and make their way to a dim, canvas-curtained hallway. They quickly embrace each other and part, before Ramona pulls a heavy sackcloth veil from around her neck and drapes it over her ovine face. She disappears between the folds of a grungy gray curtain with the words "Sheep Girl" sloppily painted on it. Natasha dashes through a gap in the musty curtain, where countless dried snakeskins are carelessly woven through the twine ropes that hold the curtain in place. Calliope music rises as she pulls herself up a rickety wooden ladder and lurches up onto the top of a tall windowed cabinet, carefully arranging herself in an outstretched manner across the top of the gleaming mahogany wood.
"Step right this way, ladies and gentlemen! Step right this way and cast your eyes upon this slithering, cursed beast, the likes of which are only seen beyond the gates of hell itself!"
barks the greasy little man. Natasha understands this to be her cue, and she hastily adjusts the hem of her dress to cover the entirety of her immense green tail.
"Behold, the Burmese Snake Woman!"
Now, lengthy red and yellow striped curtains that separate the waiting crowd of viewers from Natasha are hastily parted to reveal her before their staring eyes and wide-open mouths. At first, great gasps of anticipation emanate from the shifting group of 30 or so paying people, all crammed together to stare for a few seconds at the promised Snake Woman. The anxious group, barely held back by a sliding wooden fence framed in with chicken wire, quickly begin to grumble and complain. All they can see is an attractive lady lying on top of a cabinet that displays giant glass jars of dead snakes in oil and a few large live snakes resting in thin wired cages along the lower tabletop of the huge cabinet. The beautiful woman blankly stares out at the disappointed group. As soon as they begin to boo and hiss and demand their money back, Natasha smiles, revealing her pure white fangs. She reaches down from her perched position into one of the cages and lifts the largest wiggling snake with black diamond patches on it up to her face, and the two hiss at each other. The giant snake passes its head through her blonde tresses, and it winds itself around and around her feminine neck. The hushed crowd watches as the exacting snake draws itself tighter and tighter about her neck. Her eyes bulge out and her face turns crimson red as she struggles to breathe. A woman screams. The crowd clamors into an uproar, and in an instant, out from under the hem of the satin gown, Natasha's glistening dagger-like tail darts to her neck, pries its way between the tightening rings of the encircling boa constrictor, grasping it and slamming it to the floor, killing the strangling snake instantly. The crowd stands stunned and speechless as the red and yellow striped curtain draws closed. Natasha wipes the tears from her eyes and slinks back down the old wooden ladder. The Indigo Night has come. The shows are over. The music and commotion has stopped, and the milling troops of attendees have all departed. The mismatched band of encamped circus players can now rest and just be themselves for a little while. A small dog-faced boy is finishing his chores to earn his supper. He swept out the stalls and watered the animals and skinned the dead snake from Natasha's show. With his paw-like hands, he deftly weaves the animal's skin through the ropes that drape the rear entrance of her small stage. He peers through the curtains for a moment, envisioning all of the normal people looking on with their normal faces, imagining himself as one of them.
Jojo! Jojo! Here, lovely boy! Come and have some dinner with us!
Natasha calls out, breaking the spell of his vision. The dog boy rushes to the far corner of the circus lot, to the dappled green tent where all the freaks gather. A dull black cane swiftly blocks his snout before he can enter the tent. A drunken Mr. Pendle sneers down at him.
If it were me, I'd see you only got fed dead snakes, dog, if anything,
he snaps. The panting boy meets his gaze, then quickly ducks his nose under the cane and races to the table where the others are gathering. There was a time when Ramona would take the cowbell she was made to wear from her neck, stand upon the table and ring it to call all the others of their kind for their evening meal. Then, as they all became close friends, she began calling them differently. She would climb upon the table and call them with her violin. Every evening, the most hauntingly beautiful and touchingly sweet tune would ring out across the grounds, calling only those in their group, the odd ones, to assemble. The music made them feel special, wanted, welcome, and loved. This was the best part of the day. The best part of their lives. It's been ages now since anyone, normal or odd, has heard the achingly beautiful tune. In a drunken fit, Mr. Pendle smashed the ram-headed girl's violin. Natasha places a steaming kettle of delicious-smelling stew on the table for her friends, and takes a seat amongst them on one of the long bench seats. She cranes her neck to look for the canine boy, now pacing on all fours behind the two dwarves, a married couple who are very fond of him.
Here, boy. Here, Jojo. Come and sit at the table with me.
The panting dog boy brightens as she lifts him into the narrow spot beside her and pats his scruffy head. The old picnic-style table is crude with most of the cast of oddities that are on display in the little circus. The animal freaks, Natasha the snake woman, Ramona the sheep girl, Janet the spider woman, and Jojo the dog-faced boy. The normal freaks, conjoined twins Slick and Icky, a gaunt girl, Iris, with four legs, Julia, the bearded lady, and the tiny wedded couple, John and Mariah, boosted up on slatted milk crates. At one time or another, they've all been there for each other, rescued or guarded each other. Here, they are all equal, and they all matter. In spite of what life has handed them, their unusual physiologies, and the unhappy lives they endure. In this quiet space together, they are happy to be together. Natasha's food makes them feel loved. Before nightfall, the animal people are tied or locked away, and the odd people are sent to their sparse quarters. In a far-off village, a church bell tolls midnight. The entire circus now slumbers in their scattered tents and wagons in an abandoned farmer's field. Silvery stars slowly drift over their dreaming heads. Natasha dreams of the manor house, the books, and an obscure woman.
Get up! Get up, useless monster! It's 6 o'clock!
Bellows a stinking drunk Pindle. Natasha stirs in her cage, wincing at the lantern light dancing near her face. She knows it's actually 6 a.m. Pindle kicks her cage, screaming,
I ain't even gonna let you wear your dress, you freak!
He's done this hundreds of times, attacked her or the other performers supposedly under his care. She wraps her weighty tail tightly around herself, protecting her head and upper body the best she can. Setting the lantern down, Pindle unlocks and wrenches the door of the cage open. He clumsily digs his grimy fingers into her neatly ordered scales, dragging her out into the dirt in a cloud of flying straw. From a rip in the partitioning curtain of the tent, Ramona, the ram-headed girl, watches, helpless, chained to a post. She's not too worried. Natasha usually tells him off. She always fights him off, shoving his booze-soaked hide into a corner where he sleeps until he wakes to stomp off and be miserable elsewhere. But tonight, Pindle was more drunk than usual, and he tried something different to mistreat Natasha. So Natasha did something different too. Roughly grabbing her long hair from behind and straddling her tail, Pindle attempts to grip Natasha in a sloppy headlock.
You ain't no real woman, so I ain't gotta treat you like no real woman,
he says, spitting his slurred words into her ear. The stench of him almost makes her retch. When he slaps one grubby hand across her forehead and bends her neck back, clumsily wrestling her with his other hand and slides his wet, gritty lips across her face, a piercing, slicing sound splits the quiet, dusty air of the dimly lit tent. The crusty drunk toddles back a step, quickly standing upright, his open face glaring straight up at the center tent pole, his arms twitching at his sides. Pencil-thin lines of blood appear at the corners of his open mouth, leading straight back under his filthy earlobes in a perfect red ring. A rasping gurgle bubbles from his choking throat. As his top teeth slide backwards past his lower teeth, the entire upper part of his head, now detached, slips back and drops with a thud onto the floor, like a dollop of ice cream sliding from its cone. His bloodshot eyes blink once, then stare at their close-up view of the soft gleam of Natasha's sleek green tail, its gilded scales reflexing in unison as they come to rest. The end length of the tail, no longer a blade, but a point. Natasha, the snake woman, the beautiful creature, wriggles. Her eyes now beady with rage. Rising up on her sturdy green abdomen, she lifts her dainty pale arm and topples the half-headed dead man over with a single finger jab to his shoulder. His disheveled body collapses in a heap of puffing dust and drifting straw. Natasha's eyes twinkle in the dim light as her head gently swivels atop her neck, hypnotically tipping from side to side. Her plump pink lips curl into a brief smile, then go thin as her forked tongue parts her lips and samples the blood-misted air. She can hardly remember the last time she felt this true to herself. Now, less woman, more Leviathan. Her bottom jaw lowers and slings backward, unhinging from its rear hooked bones. Gracefully lurching forward on her hands, she glides her gaping mouth along the ground, curling her open face over the neatly sliced in half head of Mr. Pindle, swallowing it whole. Ramona, still watching from the other side of the torn tent, blinks with relief.
Natasha! Natasha! She softly calls. Come unchain me! We have to leave now!
Natasha takes a composing breath, relieves the dead man of his ring of keys, and races to unshackle her friend.
Ramona, where will we go? Who will have us?
I'll leave and you stay. You're innocent, Natasha insists while freeing her friend.
I'm already packed, says the ram girl, adding, quick, get your things, the sun's coming up.
This way, Ramona says, taking her serpent friend by the arm and pointing to a dirt road that runs along the woods. Each girl carries all that they own in the world. The ram, with a tattered leather mail pouch that holds a spare dress, the large cowbell she was once forced to wear, some worn handwritten letters, and her sole prized possession, her shattered violin. The snake, wearing her only green gown, carries a burlap sack containing three books, a magical cookbook, a damaged spellbook, and a book that possibly only a snake woman would understand. The two friends move along hastily, staying close to the woods. Finally, a few miles away, Natasha nervously asks, "Where are we going?" as she glances back the long road. "We'll just see. I always knew one day we'd have to leave or be killed," says the ram. Down a steep slope, they can see all the rooftops of a serene little hamlet with perhaps 30 or more odd houses and buildings, and farmland and hills all around it in every direction. People and horse-drawn carriages can be seen moving through the scene as they go about their day. Ramona slips her hand inside her pouch and pulls the silent cowbell from it. From under the cowl hood around her neck, she unhooks a large clapper attached to a long length of twine, looped many times around her neck. She fastens the clapper inside of the bell she's tied to the twine. Drawing her hood up over her curled horns, she tosses the bell over a branch that hangs over the road. "Heavenly Hathor, please let this work," she prays, as she tugs on the twine, ringing the heavy bell. Natasha stands speechless, watching as Ramona vigorously sounds the impressive bell. Its ring echoes off the hillsides and rooftops of the quaint, quiet burg. In a russet field of hay, a wagon that's being loaded can be seen turning around in the field and making its way onto the single road that divides the hamlet. Ramona squeals, whispering her prayer.
"Thank you, Hathor. Let's hide until we're sure,"
she says, and the two girls dash behind large trees while they watch the wagon come up the hill towards them. When it reaches the crest of the hill, the lone driver halts his horse and looks all around.
"Mona?"
the man yells out as he shades his eyes from the sun.
"Here's Akko. Here we are,"
she answers, appearing from behind the tree. The strapping farmer steps down from his wagon to greet the ram-headed girl by the side of the road. Respectfully, he doffs his hat and gently takes her small hand to grace it with a light kiss.
"Zako, can you help us, like I wrote to you about?"
she asks, her large ram eyes looking hopefully into his.
"This is Natasha Boomslang, the lady I told you about."
"Well, it's an honor to meet you, ma'am," says the farmer, lowering his head and holding his hat to his chest.
"Pleased to meet you, sir,"
Natasha awkwardly replies. She can't recall the last time she was treated so civilly, so quickly.
"We're in a heck of a hurry, Zako, and a heap of trouble if anybody finds us,"
confesses Ramona.
"We need to disappear from anywhere around here."
Zako nods reassuringly and says, "I got it all set up with my brother, Mona. Tomorrow I deliver bales down at the wharf. The old gods must really be with you, 'cause the ships don't leave for a whole day yet. Us halflings gotta help each other, don't we?" he says, smiling. Natasha looks confused, and the young man tucks his hat under his arm and reaches down with both hands to lift back the leather toes of his work boots from their soles, revealing two sturdy gray hooves. Natasha laughs with relief, and the three odd beings climb up on the hay wagon and turn back to the little rustic hamlet. After hiding in a hay barn for the night, Zako covertly delivers the girls to the marina to his brother Toro, who works as a quartermaster. The early morning wharf and landing are bustling with activity. The entire scene is blanketed in a warm, enchanting fog, a velvety silver cloud dotted with the golden glow of hanging yellow lanterns. In a small covered building, the two scared girls, close friends for years now, say their goodbyes. When Natasha looks into Ramona's big dark eyes, she shakes the thought from her head that they may never see each other again. Ramona cries instantly. Even Zako is sad for them. As they embrace, perhaps for one last time. Because of Ramona's obvious ram face, Toro arranges for her to be hidden on board a different ship from Natasha, a livestock ship, the Staghound, where she's dressed to blend in with a herd of black sheep. Natasha, whose lower snake half is easier to conceal, is to board the Mystique, a hardy clipper ship known for its secretive captain and crew. There's a joke Zako told the girls that the Mystique's logbook just reads, "None of your business," on every page. The snake woman stands alone, reluctant to step onto the gangplank of the grand ship. Toro arrives in a worn but stylish brown frock coat and leather cap. He quickly bows and confidently loops his arm through Natasha's, ushering her aboard the Mystique. He graciously carries a suitcase given to her by Zako. It contains only her three precious books. As the pair cross the deck of the three-masted ship, they inadvertently catch the eye of every other passenger and crew member as they make a most fetching couple. Toro tilts his head toward Natasha and whispers, "Miss Boomslang, you are my guest, and I'll do my best to keep you safe. Let's go have a word with the captain." Without breaking her stride, Natasha cautiously asks, "Should I be frightened?" Toro's weathered cheeks plump as a grin grows across his face.
"If what my brother tells me is true, miss, it is the captain who may be frightened of you," he states.
Natasha blushes and relaxes her arm linked with his.
"Captain Magnus, sir, may I introduce Miss Natasha Boomslang. She is to be my charge on this voyage upon your fine ship,"
Toro respectfully proclaims. He leans in toward the captain to more quietly add,
"I respectfully request that she should be transported to the unnamed inlet, sir, in order to increase the odds of her survival."
Captain Magnus only lifts his chin and blinks to signal he's heard the request. Magnus, a most peculiar man, burly and dark with a forbidden appeal about him. He seems at once both dangerous and elegant. Natasha did find that she was, in some way, frightened of him. It could have been the hanged man's scar across his throat, or the sight of familiar symbols from her damaged spellbook, tattooed in blood-red ink across his sinewy hands. Some of the symbols she'd never seen before.
when his coal black eyes darted from Toro's to look into her own. She thought she saw a fleeting warmth.
We'll see what the fates allow, Mr. Brahman. Ma'am?
He added, looking straight through the snake woman. Quartermaster Toro then accompanied Natasha across the upper deck, and then below deck, giving her a tour of the splendid vessel before showing her to her sleeping quarters. As they walked upon nearly every surface of the majestic wooden ship, her keen eyes discerned tiny carvings in the wood, thousands upon thousands of sacred symbols. The journey was like no other, neither written about in moth-eaten old books, nor bragged of in smoky taverns by blathering old seamen. Natasha was provided her own semi-private bunk in Toro's own quarters. She was not hidden or sequestered in any way. She was free and respected. But she was told that if she chose to leave the two-room suite and wandered about alone, that there were corridors and corners of the ship where her safety could not be guaranteed. Having only read about glorious sea-bound expeditions, and never having been on board a ship before, and never even hearing of such a ship as the Mystique, Natasha chose to stay in Toro's quarters on board the starboard side of the great ship. The things she had read about, as far as she could tell, were not the things that happened aboard the Mystique. A strange window in the upper beams of the hull, made from the circular bottoms of 13 wine bottles, gave the only hint of day and night that she could perceive. Some days were endlessly bright, with perhaps more than 20 hours of sun, while some nights seemed even longer. At times, battering storms could be heard, with lightning striking in every direction and blasting winds that Natasha was certain would blow them off course. But the Mystique barely even swayed. It glided along on the ocean as though it were a swan on a mirror-still pond. One night, as Natasha lay awake in her bunk, she spoke to Toro, who was only a few feet away, saying, "Toro, there's something about this ship, isn't there?" Toro was silent. "Is it cursed?" she pointedly asked. Toro, in his nightcap and long shirt, lit a tiny oil lamp and walked the few steps over to Natasha. With the soft glow of the lamplight between them, he said,
"No, Miss Boomslang, the Mystique isn't cursed. It's protected."
With this, he removed his nightcap and bowed his head, revealing a set of small bovine horns. Natasha smiled.
"Sleep well, sweet dreams,"
Toro said, quickly planting the lightest kiss on her cheek. Another night, Toro could hear Natasha quietly weeping. He arrived at her bunk, gently touching her hand.
"What's wrong, Natasha? What can I do?"
he whispered to her.
"Oh, Toro, I'm losing them. My memories of all of the people in the circus. My odd little friends. I can't see their faces right. Ramona's violin. I can't recall the tune. That monster destroyed the music, Toro. It was the one thing that united us like a family. It made anywhere we were a home for all of us. And now I can't remember. I'm losing them."
As she dissolved into tears, Toro climbed into her bunk and held her as she wept, her face buried in his strong shoulder. In the wee hours of some unknown day, the curious ship coasted to a quiet halt upon the water, and the plunge and splash of the anchor was heard. Outside of the quartermaster's cabin, the captain's voice cried out,
"Mr. Brahman, ready your charge or miss your chance!"
Toro leapt from his bunk and threw on his long coat and cap. "Miss Natasha," he tenderly called out.
"I'm ready, Toro," she answered.
Swiftly gathering the few things she was given on board the ship, a spare nightgown that belonged to Toro, a whalebone with the mystique scrimshawed into it, and a tortoiseshell comb for her hair. Before the roommates left their cabin, as Natasha bent to tuck her tail into the pocket of her gown, Toro drew her to him and placed a gentle kiss upon her lips. Three souls would row ashore in the foggy morning air this day. Zim, a young deckhand, Quartermaster Toro, and Natasha Boomslang. Two dutifully returned to the Mystique, waiting motionless upon the choppy sea. The misty inlet, a sandy, crescent-shaped beach, was narrow and surrounded by tall trees. Natasha made her way through the seagrass and entered the woods, knowing that in a short while on the other side of the woods, she would have to face civilization. She straightened her dress and neatened her hair into an upsweep, securing it with the fine comb Toro had given her. She scuttled along, taking in the sounds of the breeze, the rich musky smell of the woods, and spotting wildlife moving through the treed landscape for hours. Not only was no town revealed, the woods grew deeper, dimmer, and more overgrown. Soon, she came to a small babbling stream, with its far shore covered in dark shimmering sand. Running perfectly straight, it almost seemed to be a boundary, a line of demarcation. With no other choice present, Natasha crossed the cooling brook, and what appeared to be dark sand was actually black salt. As the peach-colored sun reclines itself in the sky, sending its pinkish-orange rays through the heavily timbered landscape, pleasant but sorrowful music rises up from the wooded floor. Glittering wings of tiny butterflies, damselflies, and amethyst-winged dragonflies sparkle as they flit in and out of the shining rays. Natasha stops abruptly when she realizes what she's in the midst of. It's a procession. Out from under a jumble of moss-covered boulders, some etched with spirals and Celtic looped knots, a tiny traveling troupe of mourners emerges. A fairy funeral. Wee musicians in jackets of leaves, playing their minuscule instruments, walk behind a miniature version of a large white mare, about 6 inches tall. She's bridled in mourning gear and drags a bright green magnolia leaf tied to her tail with wild grapevine tendrils. The leaf bears the deceased, a peaceful male pixie resting on a bed of cherry blossoms, his arms folded across his chest. On both sides of the departed, grieving elves, brownies, gnomes, and other pixies somberly march along, some with their wings drooping, their heads hung low, and their tiny acorn cap hats held over their hearts. They remind Natasha of how sad she is to be missing her friends. When the funeral pageant has passed, an exhausted Natasha begins to look for a spot to spend the night in the unfamiliar woods. She decides to turn back a few steps to check for a suitable den amongst the boulders. There she discovers a small leaf-littered enclave. Normally, she would sleep as nature intended, especially for one such as she. She would sleep in the nude. But having just been parted from her caring friend, Toro, she chooses to sleep in the soft cotton nightgown he gave to her. Draping her dress over a large rock, she dons the nightgown and curls herself up in the cool little lair. She pulls the embroidered collar of the gown close to her nose to breathe in the heady scent of wood and salt water it still holds from her time aboard the Mystique. Her dreams are a flowing spectacle of shifting scenes, a menagerie, a blending of beings and places, known and unknown, some cobbled together as they've never really been, or may even possibly be. Pindle, with his upper head still missing, swabs the deck of the Mystique, while a pack of wolves stalk him. That mysterious woman cradles a basket of snakes like those she was forced to kill. They slither into their seats at a dining table. Toro stands smiling with a heavy book in his hands. He is hatless, with his horns much longer. He looks straight at her from a dim hallway of the Grand Mansion. And drifting through every scene, Ramona's poignant violin ballad. Natasha wakes weeping, the music quickly fading away from memory. The sound of thundering hoofbeats pound the ground, shaking Natasha's lonely cove. She squints out from her stony nook into the pre-dawn light. A blur of galloping horses' legs tear past her damp den. Her sleepy eyes see men among the far horses, but no horses. Centaurs, she whispers, knowing this truly is a strange land. She watches in silence as the mythically real creatures disappear into the woods. For the first time in so many days, Natasha's reptilian stomach grumbles. When she lived with the circus troupe and did some of the cooking, she had access to much that would please a snake woman. Jojo, the dog boy, was good at catching birds and rabbits, and the handlers kept caged chickens that provided fresh eggs. Much of the same fare was available during her time aboard the ship, where her meals were delivered by Toro. It's been ages since she was left to hunt in the wild, but her lips curl as she imagines it. Casting her eyes around the lush forest and not seeing anyone, Natasha slings her gifted nightgown off and carefully folds it away. In a flash, she turns and drops, darting into a spreading bed of jack-in-the-pulpit flowers, with no breakfast hiding in them. Thinking she detects the scent of a bird, she next winds her way low to the ground, weaving through a grove of umbrella-like mayflowers, only to find the leftover feathers from a hawk's greedy breakfast. Peering into the distance, she catches a momentary glance of a horned being, perhaps a moose or an elk. Too much for me, she thinks. Now feeling tired and a bit weak with hunger, Natasha remembers where there's almost always some food to be found. Hoping not to have to get into the water, she heads for a pond she recalls seeing. The sprawling pond, with a quaint island in the middle, is surrounded by high weeds, ornamental grasses and reeds, and waving beds of cat-o'-nine-tails. Slinking her way through them, she spies several large rats wrestling around inside an old rib cage. In the blink of an eye, two of them are plucked to end her hunger. As Natasha lifts her head and the tail of the last rat disappears from her lips, the antlered being stands towering over her, shaking its fleshless bony head with disdain. It's not a moose. It's not an elk. Natasha has seen this being before in her damaged spellbook. It's a Wendigo. The half-rotted creature reaches down, grasping her spindly arm firmly with its skeletal hand, easily lifting her to its side. In silence, Natasha is forcibly chaperoned by the imposing Wendigo through the rambling forest, passing holloways, open meadows, and primeval groves of dense pines as they go. Finally, they reach a large crescent pool, surrounded by hazy blue wooded lands. An ancient stone structure stands there, partially built out into the water. The mossy, six-sided, two-story structure resembles a small castle, complete with a serrated keep rising up out of its hexagonal base that's bedecked with gleaming diamond-patterned windows, glinting in the sunlight. Flying over the keep waves a drab red flag that bears a crest with a crowned rat in its center. The Wendigo stoops to gather and toss a few pebbles at the fortress, with some stones splashing into the encircling water. Suddenly, the largest rat Natasha has ever seen pops up in a suit of armor along the high wall of the keep and waves a yellow flag. The looming Wendigo then jostles the snake woman through the wide wooden door of the odd little castle. Both the Wendigo and the snake woman intuitively bow before the being seated on a brilliant risen throne before them. He is the Rat King, a huge and brawny man, dressed in medieval-style leather garb, with a brass bejeweled chalice within reach of his left hand, and a tall gleaming spear in his right. With his wavy auburn hair and thick braided beard framing his magnificent face, it's easy to miss his crown of live wriggling rats, their tails tightly interlocked in a permanently wadded knot over the top of his gallant head. The Wendigo holds up two bare-boned fingers on his free hand while shoving Natasha to the floor at the foot of the Rat King's throne. The full view of her half-woman, half-snake body lies outstretched upon the cold gray slabs, her flaxen hair thrown over her face.
"Thank you, faithful friend. I will deal with her,"
speaks the dynamic king. When the Wendigo attempts to signal the king a second time, the Rat King repeats in anger,
"I said I will deal with her."
The Wendigo bows and retreats from the castle.
"Rise, dear child,"
the Rat King softly commands. Natasha peers out from between the strands of her stringy hair, slowly coming upright to balance on the bulk of her reptilian lower half.
"Can you speak?"
he calmly asks. With her hands clasped over her green belly and her eyes cast down, I'm sorry, sir," Natasha meekly says.
"Look at me,"
asserts the rodent king.
"You've eaten two of my great offspring,"
he solemnly proclaims, now shyly meeting the handsome ruler's gaze. Natasha notices two fine sprays of white whiskers
emanating from the sides of his chiseled nose. Her eyes glance up at his vermin crown in motion. Natasha begins.
Shh,
the Rat King interrupts, smiling.
Now I only have 1,687,483 left. I can't lose too many more, or I won't have enough to terrorize Phantom Forest and the surrounding towns.
He bursts out laughing. The Snake Woman blushes, raising her hand to cover her smile in disbelief.
Do you eat humans, my dear?
He frankly asks. I prefer not to, sir. My dream is to keep them mystified. Natasha meekly confesses.
Ah, now I know where you belong,
says the confident Murine King. What the benevolent ruler did next set in motion a rapid succession of progressing good for Natasha. First, he called for his scribe, a young three-quarter rat, to pen a plea to Miranda Merrick. Next, he directed his messenger, a half-rat, to deliver the missive to the nest of Professor Steerpike, the Midnight Library's longtime associate and confidant. Steerpike, having received the letter, could have easily flown into the third-story window of the library and delivered the letter directly into the hands of his longtime master and sometimes student, Miranda Merrick. But the wise ancient Corvid was never one known to be predictable. He preferred to bring his master shiny things, rings he had found from cadavers and the like. And since the letter wasn't shiny, instead, he dropped the letter into the hood of the introverted goth girl who delivers the Midnight Library's mail, Lydia. Lydia grimaced at the black swooping bird and pulled the letter from her hood, seemingly unsurprised. Stopping to read the address, "The Midnight Library, of course," she said in her blasé way, rolling her eyes, ringed with smoky black liner. "It doesn't have a stamp," spoke the warm, lilting voice of Stefan Strangeways, now standing before her as she walked her route in the village. "Hi, Stefan," Lydia blushed, which she hated to do. "It's okay. Rules are for fools," she quipped. "It's mighty kind of you, Miss Lydia. I'm sure it will be much appreciated," said Stefan, his sapphire eyes twinkling as he walked away. "Hey, maybe I'll see you at a reading," Lydia called out.
"Well, you just might, Miss Lydia,"
Stefan said, touching the brim of his suede cowboy hat. Saving the weird letter for last, Lydia meandered her way through Phantom Forest. The afternoon sun was still far above the horizon, illuminating a rising full moon. She soaked up the sublime gloom of the woods. As she reached the edge of the forest, where the more noticeable tombstones begin, Lydia paused as an enormous wolf leapt to the top of an ornate gray crypt protruding from a mound of earth along the forest's rim. The magnificent animal stood a distance away, facing her. In the blue haze of the warm afternoon,
right before her eyes, the wolf rose up on its hind legs and transformed into the gentleman, John Darley. Lydia's mouth dropped open. She felt as though she'd been given a gift, her heart now full. After following him from far behind, "Mr. Darling, sir," she nervously called out to him.
"Good evening, Miss Lydia,"
he smiled, tilting his top hat, while driving his gaze into her staring eyes, his secret now standing between them. She blushed again.
Here's a letter for you, sir," said Lydia, with the worn envelope trembling in her hand.
"Oh, how very good of you to deliver to us out here,"
exclaimed Darling, adding,
"You've always struck me as someone trustworthy,"
his thick brows politely rising. "Oh, yes, sir. The library is like the most important thing, sir, and everybody in it, and it's all way important, sir,"
rambled the goth postal girl, nodding.
"Safe travels, Miss Lydia,"
smiled Mr. Darling. "Right. Good night, sir," grinned Lydia, slowly backing away from John Darling. Darling calmly entered the library, then tore up the stairs to the séance room.
"Madam, the Rat King's letter is here!"
Darling shouted, bounding into the room.
"Calm down, darling, stop jumping," directed Miss Merrick.
"Just as it was foretold, she's coming, and we'll all have that glorious food. That stuff the demons make tastes like dog food, I assume. Did you know, madam, it even makes them vomit? Perhaps that's what they're serving us,"
he wondered out loud, then excitedly asks,
"Madam, please may I go get her?"
"Mr. Darling, please. Everything must play out in its own time. Now let me read the Rat King's letter," Miranda Merrick insisted.
"But you already know what it says,"
retorted Darling, spinning quickly around, his wolf tail swishing out from his coattails.
"Sit!"
the witch commanded, and the wolfman sat, impatiently, as his companion read the heart-rending words penned in the Rat King's beseeching missive. When she read the Rat King's impassioned words, sincerely insisting that the Midnight Library was most certainly Natasha's only hope for a happy home, she began to tear up.
"Yes. She belongs here. Everyone here. We're her family. Mr. Darling, will you please go at once and look for her?"
she implored.
"That's what I've been insisting, you silly woman. I don't know how long it will take to find and fetch her,"
Darling exclaimed, his snout now outstretched from his face. "Do you know, darling, I think you may also have some retriever in you," she replied, teasing him with a sly smile. "Take as long as it takes to find her. I'll have everything in place when you return, even if I have to use every trick in the book," she said with a wink and sprang to her feet. John Darling, the wolf now fully formed, raced from the library into the surrounding forest, his lifted lupine nose twitching as he ran. He paused on any and all risen hills to cast his keen eyes all around, peering into the distance. Turning his tall, erect ears, he detected the sound of digging and charged off in the direction of the sound, passing right through a group of dancing spirits. He thought briefly of asking them if they had seen the snake woman. Then he remembered how fond of pranks the spirits are, and continued his sprint until he reached the group of grave-digging ladies, working and laughing as they tossed around and swapped the skulls and bones of several skeletons they were having fun with before burying.
"Well, good afternoon, Mr. Darling," exclaimed Big Lou, as the large wolf arrived with an abrupt halt. "Would you like a nice bone, sir?" she politely added.
"Not just now, Miss Lou, but thank you. Ladies," he addressed them, "I'm looking for a snake woman. Not a shapeshifter, just a regular halfling. Have you seen one such as this in your travels?"
he asked.
"Would that be Natasha Boomslang? We've met her several times, even provided her with some cast-offs at times,"
volunteered Big Lou, the others nodding in agreement.
"Yes, Natasha. That's the lady we're looking for. She's to be our new kitchen mistress,"
said Darling excitedly. "Thanks, Cersei, for that," interjected Penny, recalling some dodgy dinners she'd attended. Within the hour, the League of Lady Gravediggers, along with Mr. Darling, trekked to the damp little neck of the woods they had last seen Natasha residing in. It was the only corner of Phantom Forest with spreading magnolia trees, draped in graceful Spanish moss, drifting with the breeze. There, in the lowering beams of sunlight, the beautiful snake woman lay napping on a massive magnolia branch that swept down and along the forest floor, her magical serpent book clutched to her bosom, her long tail protruding from the foot of her dress, resting in a mound of wild heather. The Lady Gravediggers quietly departed. Now back in gentleman form, John Darling softly cleared his throat to wake the sleeping Natasha. Natasha, just now dreaming of some unknown familiarity, opened her eyes in disbelief. "Do I know you, sir?" she meekly said, thinking herself to be dreaming.
I know you, miss," spoke the genteel man as he doffed his hat and spoke his name out loud. "I'm John Darling. I'm here to rescue you."
When she realized she wasn't dreaming, Natasha instantly retracted her tail beneath the hem of her long green gown. Now fully awake, he did seem familiar to her, like an old friend.
"Please, let me help you with your things, Miss Natasha."
His voice broke slightly as he said her name, realizing that she too was somehow an old friend. As the two set off walking along together, crossing the expanse of the weird and mystical forest, they told each other the most amazing things. It was as though they had always known each other. Natasha recalled as much as she could from her humble beginnings, then told of being captured and sold, and forced to perform in the circus. She spoke of her love for her ragtag family of misfits, and of her time aboard the Mystique. She spoke of not fitting in, of loss, of loneliness, and heartbreak. Darling, having great pity for Natasha's hardships, thought he could lift her heart with stories of his life as a mischievous shape-shifting wolf pup. Then he cheerfully moved on, then telling her of his meeting or re-meeting with Ms. Merrick and all of the hijinks that go on in the Midnight Library and the village. And he did manage to get her to giggle several times, although he could tell how lost she truly felt. Her eyes. It showed in her eyes. On the edge of the forest, amongst the sparse tombstones and random pumpkins, they paused together, looking up at the grand mansion, silhouetted in the rays of the glorious setting red sun. Natasha could hardly believe her eyes as they climbed the wide stony steps to the great gate of the landing. She believed she was dreaming and hoped to never wake. As they passed through the gate, Mr. Darling bowed, making a sweeping gesture with his open hand, insisting that she walk first along the enchanting veranda that flowed in a curve around the side of the charming old estate. In this moment, the familiar melody rang out. Natasha's heart began to pound as she raced around the side of the grand mansion. There, in a gilded garden, stood Ramona, the ram-headed girl, playing her violin, the soulful tune filling the sweet air. Behind her, a long incandescent table lined with smiling faces. Janet, Slick and Icky, Iris, Julia, John and Mariah, and Jojo wagging his tail. Natasha swayed in shock at the sight of all of her friends in the beautiful sunset garden. Pendle once told her she'd never see heaven. She knew this was just as good. Miranda Merrick, the dark woman from her dreams, approached Natasha and bowed with her hand over her heart, then elegantly swept her open hand toward an enormous oak tree, dancing with dappled sunlight. From behind the tree stepped Toro. Natasha's heart broke open. She was home. That night, they danced. Darlin, Miranda, Stefan, Irma, Ramona, Zako, Toro, and Natasha. All of her old friends, now with her new ones. From that day forward, Natasha lived in bliss in the forbidden old mansion, filled with even more odd beings that would become her loving friends. We in the Midnight Library would like to invite you to be part of our odd little family. Please visit us often and stay as long as you like. And please, make yourself at home. Carefully. Of course.
Oh, wasn't it the most fabulous evening and homecoming for our Natasha, madam?
Oh, it was, darling. Although I was a little embarrassed when you asked the woman to make you a snack when she'd only just arrived.
Well, I was surprised you allowed her to do it. It was a delicious tray of cheese-filled bones. Wait a minute. Was there a pill in that cheese? The two of you tricked me into taking a pill.
Oh, not just any pill, darling. A worm pill.
A worm pill? Well, how many worms do I get?
Well, at least a good dozen or so, I would think.
Yippee!
The Midnight Library would like to thank everyone at Astonishing Legends. Our excellent sound design is by Chris at Sounds Like an Earful. If you are enjoying your evenings in the reading room, we invite you to join your dark companions and help keep the Midnight Library open and the beasties fed. Please visit patreon.com/midnightlibrary, where you can contact me directly. Seek us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Our bizarre merch can be found at redbubble.com/people/midnightlibrary.